Sober on Purpose is the podcast that takes you beyond clean to fulfilling your dreams. Other programs get you sober. We ask, what's next? Come thrive with us.
Hello, Sober on Purpose family. I have a guest that I have been thrilled to meet. I've read her book a couple times. I did some live training on it, but now we get to hear it from Stephanie Sarazen herself. She is a certified grief coach and educator. And how I came to know her, and in fact, I stumbled upon her, was through her book, Soul Broken, which is a Nautilus Book Award-winning book in the gold category of grief. And this is something that when I work with women, I find that, hey, we're willing to recognize sadness. We're willing to recognize fear, anger even, but grief, we don't have a whole lot of context for grief. And Stephanie can tell us exactly why she brought a term for grief into my life that I have never heard before. So welcome, Stephanie.
Oh, hi, Tanya. Thanks so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here with you.
Awesome. Can you describe it? It broke my whole world open when you began to discuss ambiguous grief and what that is.
Yeah, thanks. It broke my world open too, because for me, it was a breadcrumb I needed to begin my own healing. I am a grief educator, as you said, and work with people one-on-one, working through ambiguous grief. But that certainly wasn't what I aspired to, growing up. It's something that I, right, I found really as a calling along the way. And it happened after I discovered my marriage of 18 years wasn't what I believed it to be. I absolutely loved my marriage. I wasn't one of these people looking for an out, Sure. But my marriage ended quite suddenly, and it left me in just a state of despair and depression and sadness and anger and confusion and just all of the things. And, I felt like I had lost such a big part of me, lost my partner, lost my, my marriage, lost my identity in some ways, mm-hmm. And, I just wasn't feeling, like I thought I should be feeling, which might sound kind of peculiar. It is to me, even as I say it, but having gone through loss before in terms of, people in my life who have died, mm-hmm. I felt like, gosh, it feels like that, but it's a little different. And where are my casseroles? Right. I say this with absolutely all respect to widows and widowers who have lost their partner, their spouse to a physical death, it's heartbreaking, right? It's such a deeply personal, painful experience. I've witnessed others have, and I felt that was the closest thing I could align it to, Tanya, was I feel like maybe I feel like I'm a widow, but I'm not being treated like one. Mm. And divorce isn't death. I absolutely understand that. But in search of, healing, I just wasn't getting any better. I wasn't feeling any better. And as I started to kind of come out of it, I was, careful about who I spoke to about it and was looking for anybody who could talk to me about what to do, like how to feel better, how to make this pain go away. And what I found is that nobody was talking about it. Nobody knew anybody, even though I knew I could not be the only person in my network who had something like this happen, or who, knew somebody who they could put in touch, with me. I felt very isolated, very alone. And as I started to kind of come out of it and find my people and find others who were having the experience, I thought, if I could intellectualize this, if I could understand what makes it different, I could really feel better. I could, get back to the old me.
Yeah.
And I have a background, I have a master's in public policy, again, like so far away from, grief coaching. But I applied what I knew from that life and started doing some research, put together some surveys, co-authored the Ambiguous Grief Process Model. And, you know, thanks to so many other grievers explaining and sharing their stories with me, I was able to really garner understanding, you know, that that grief isn't something that we experience only when somebody dies. Grief is pervasive, in fact. And when we grieve somebody who is not gone to a physical death, but who is no longer in our life as they once were, we don't have the societal norms to engage. We don't have a funeral, a eulogy. That's why I wasn't getting casseroles.
Casseroles.
And so without, you know, it's important because there's so much to be said about rituals, but without any of those societal norms, the grieving process becomes ambiguous. We don't know what to say. We don't know what others know, if it's somebody, it's happening, you know, we see this happening to our friends or family, we don't know how to interact with them. Mm-hmm. And so from there, my work in ambiguous grief really took off. And I found that there are far more activating events than just discovery and divorce, which was my situation.
Can you list out some of the other activating events that happen with ambiguous grief?
Yeah, absolutely. So through my research, I found people were commenting, there's so many, but these were the most common. Divorce and discovery, as I said, cognitive decline, dementia, mm-hmm. Alzheimer's, anything mm-hmm. in that space, incarceration, mm-hmm. indoctrination, if you think about a cult or a gang, mm-hmm. estrangement, where they're just, you know, they're gone. And of course, addiction, mm-hmm. substance abuse, you know, where something, either a behavior or a substance, has changed our loved one in a profound way, and they are no longer who they once were. And as so many of us are going through these experiences, it really was incredible to learn we're not talking about it. We're not talking about it, I believe, because we don't want to be talked about, right? So if shame or embarrassment is somehow internalized by us, you know, because of why we are no longer in a relationship with our person, or why I'm, you know, someone might not be sharing updates about their adult child, or, you know, whatever the case may be, if shame and embarrassment are internalized and attached to that activating event, we're going to isolate and grieve alone. You know, we don't want to talk about it.
When you say, let's talk about one activating event, and then how does grieving differentiate from sadness, or other feelings that might be in there?
Yeah, and this is where it's interesting, right? Because we can have, and exploring our feelings and really being able to name our feelings, which I talk about in the book, is so important, right? Because so many of us just don't have the language. Not only do we not have the language for, oh, this is grief, right? We don't have the language for all of the feelings that we're experiencing that make up grief. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the most kind of common understanding of grief is, you know, what we just said, one, that it's associated with the loss of somebody through a physical death, and that, you know, the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when she was working in her book on death and dying, when, you know, she kind of outlined the stages of grief, mm-hmm. that include anger, bargaining, denial, depression, acceptance, and most recently, meaning was added to that as well. You know, that wasn't intended back then, and still isn't intended to be, you know, the roadmap for what to expect. That's what people were experiencing as they were facing their own imminent deaths, right? Mm-hmm. They were having these experiences, that was their own personal grief over their own personal death experience happening, right? But but Dr. Ross certainly did identify so many experiences that we have in the process, whether it's us grieving ourselves or grieving the loss of somebody else or, you know, a component of our life. And so, you know, back to your question, I think if we can better understand, like, okay, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling nervous, I'm feeling just being able to get in touch with and naming what we're feeling and then trying to understand the root of it. You know, if it's happening every day, if it's constant, in one way or the next, it might be grief, right? And this is something, my intention is not to be crude. I found this working with a client to be true for her. If you are jealous of a widow, you might be experiencing ambiguous grief, right? If you can look at somebody in your life who is in the utmost pain and grieving the loss of their partner, whether it's a partner of 5 months or 50 years, it doesn't matter. To lose your spouse is a very big deal, right? And if you find yourself thinking, I want what they have, you might be experiencing ambiguous grief, because ambiguous grievers aren't given the opportunity to have their grief witnessed.
Yes.
And if our grief isn't witnessed, it's not validated.
We can't validate it ourselves. So in my own story, 25 years ago, maybe more than 25 years ago, I divorced my first husband. We divorced. Wonderful man. He went on to live his own life. And I found myself saying sometimes to other people, not because I wished him dead, but I'm like, this would be easier if he had died. Like you said, the funeral would happen, the casseroles would happen, I'd be able to talk about it. And 25 years ago, this was not, there were just really not a whole lot of terminologies. Now you can have celebrations for your divorce. You go out after the court. I'm not suggesting that's right or wrong. I'm just saying it's much more open. But the other thing that really captivated me was I was grieving him as a person, but I was also grieving, as you said earlier, the state of marriage, that I liked being married. I liked being a wife. I liked being all these things, which when we come to addiction and recovery and those types of things, there was a person who was there that you shared a connection with, that you enjoyed, and maybe that connection has shifted, or maybe, like you said, it may be estranged, it may be not connected anymore. And in your book, you talk, this is something that I found so profound. We look at external hope, like, well, maybe they'll get sober, or maybe they'll stop working so hard, or maybe they'll give up the porn addiction, or maybe they'll do this. But you also talk about internal hope. Can you explain the difference between those two?
Yes. Thank you for asking, because this was the big aha for me. And this was the differentiator in what makes ambiguous grief different. Mm-hmm. And in all of the responses to the survey and interviewing so many people, overwhelmingly, there was hope. And so the activating event happens, whatever that may be. And we experience a range of emotions and feelings that can be defined under the umbrella of grief, right? And then hope comes in. And so we're having, you know, bargaining, depression, acceptance, anger. We're even having joy. We're having maybe an inner calling to really live. Everybody grieves differently. And so the feelings are really, you know, can look like anything, above and beyond what Dr. Ross had suggested in that research. But for ambiguous grievers, hope pops up.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the other feelings, you know, this, it's not linear. We can experience hope, heavily one day, and then not again for 3 months, and then just a little, and then we're back to, you know, all in on hope. And I do want to preface this, Tanya, and say, so as to not alienate any listeners, hope, I understand, is a good thing. Hope is a virtue in Catholicism. It is something we need in this human experience. Absolutely. For ambiguous grievers, I believe that hope can be as dangerous as it is good. And here's why.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we're grieving and we're feeling heavy and sad, depressed, whatever is that heavy, you know, void that you feel, maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's anger, just that feeling that you just want to climb out of yourself. You just don't want to be there anymore, right? And then hope presents. Oh, and hope is, as Emily Dickinson famously wrote, hope is that thing with feathers that perches on the soul and sings a tune without the words and never stops at all. Oh, thank you, hope. Thank you, Emily. You know, that is just, it's, I always say it's Cinderella's bluebirds come to mind, and it's just right, oh yes, hope, come back and visit me and perch here on my soul. But for an ambiguous griever, that hope might be more like the Iago parrot, that annoying parrot from The Lion King, and not so much the bluebird, right? Because it is squawking and it's nonstop. And so external hope is that parrot. It is when we are hoping in the direction of our loved one. And so, you know, I say hope, if you can think of hope as a double agent, right? It's both birds. It's good and it's annoying. And so external hope is when we are looking outward to the person we love, to the relationship we're grieving, and we're saying, okay, how can I fix this? What can I do to get this back on track? And if I could just fix that person, my son, my daughter, my mother, my father, my spouse, whatever, whoever, my best friend, like anybody you're grieving. And if I could just fix that behavior, if I could just, oh, you know, I'm going to find the right doctor. I'm going to find the right treatment center. I'm going to do an intervention. You know, we start to plan and we attach to that plan the outcome we're trying to get to for ourselves, which is to fix them.
So well, we and I would say we attach ourselves to that plan so that if it does not go to plan, we have failed. Our worth is underground at this point. And you've said my favorite phrase, when you are in the if he would just phase, that's when you need to pause and step out and look at whose life you're living.
That's right. If you look, and I write about this too, is, you know, external hope sounds like, just as you said,
if I could only, right?
Uh-huh. And the hard truth to that is that it's not true. That isn't going to fix it, but it feels good to be in action. It feels good to take action. It feels good to be optimistic and forward thinking. And we want to feel good. Hope is effervescent in that way. And so we want to stay there. But if we stay there too long in that space of external hope, we run a dangerous risk for ourselves. And there's something in the DSM-5 that is called prolonged grief disorder. It's recently been renamed. It used to be known as complicated grief. And this is something that me, as a certified grief coach, I can't help you with. I am not a clinician. If you are finding yourself overwhelmed with thoughts of your loved one, if the loss of this relationship has really just overtaken your life, if you feel hopeless, if you feel stuck, I call it the visual I have for it is quicksand. Like you just can't get yourself out. You identify now by the being in. Associated with this loss. That's who you are. You've experienced this loss. That's kind of singularly your domain. And if you find yourself here, which in my research I did, I found people were stuck and didn't know how to get out for periods passing 10 years. And so you need to talk to a therapist who understands this kind of grief and can work with you to move through it, because you can't do it alone. Nobody can hand you a stick and pull you out of this quicksand. But if we can catch it too soon, you know, early enough, we can catch it soon. We can redirect the focus, and the redirection would be the practice of internal hope. And that internal hope, right, is hoping, turning the light on me, turning the light on you, and saying, okay, I'm going to start hoping for myself without this relationship. And trying to detach from whatever, however it may resolve, or not.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it may be, we can still hold space for our loved one and not have them in our life. And in that internal hope, we're thinking about what life looks like. We're reimagining our life without this person, without this relationship. And Tanya, it stinks. It's hard. Yes. It's hard because it for some people I found, oh, that hope is the last piece of their loved one that they're holding on to.
Yes.
And I'm not suggesting we abandon hope and don't believe that our loved one will, you know, become sober, will work to heal whatever it is that has, you know, been the cause of the root of the issue, for whatever the grief is, but we can't count on it. We can only control ourselves. And so turning our effort and our energy into, okay, what does it look like if I don't have a 20-year wedding anniversary? What does it look like if I don't have grandchildren? What does it look like if I don't have a daughter I can talk about on social media because she's in treatment again? Whatever the case may be, whatever the loss, being able to turn that hope onto ourselves is a powerful step in healing.
Well, and what I'm hearing is letting go of trying to fix them, because if I make them okay, then I'm okay. What I'm hearing you say is I can be okay. I can even love them, even though they don't choose to do what I think they need to do, because I've chosen to take care of myself. I've chosen to love myself. I've chosen to create hope in myself. I've stopped giving over my power for wellness to something I cannot control, which is another person.
That's right. That's right. And that really is what it means to give it over to God, right? Is to say, to detach from the thinking that you are powerful enough to change someone else's life trajectory when you didn't, you can't control it. You can't cure it. Right.
Right.
But we can have compassion for it. And again, yes, we can still love somebody and we can help them and we can offer support. Certainly in the beginning, of course. And for some people, that support is what our loved ones need to get that help. So I'm not saying don't start by trying to help, but if you've been in this for a while, and you know, people listening will know what that means. You know, if you're in it and you're noticing that this is same old, then you have a decision to make. And just because you allow that relationship energy to shift to you doesn't mean that you're taking your love for that person with it. You can still absolutely hold love. You can still absolutely wish them well and protect your peace and cultivate hope in your own life.
Well, and this is what I talk about a lot, is you're not powerless over your own life. You can give away your power to somebody else, but you're not powerless over your own life. And this is where I think the grieving process comes in, because you talk about the cycling around this and how this isn't going to be boom, I'm recovered, nor is it going to be for the person you love either. So talk about that cycling piece, because I found that really insightful too.
Thank you. And this is where hope is the double agent, because, you know, even as you're practicing internal hope, and it's rocky and it feels uncomfortable and it's hard, but you're doing it. And just to say too, some examples of that might be, internal hope sounds like, I want to experience this in my life. I want to try something new. I would like to meet new people. I'm going to go to that knitting circle. I'm going to go try out that new coffee shop, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to take up, something I've always been interested in.
Skiing.
I'm going to become a skier and move to Colorado. Like whatever it is for you, that's you fulfilling something within you, right?
Yeah.
For you. And so if, you know, you can be on that road and feeling good about you and, you know, going down your mountains, skiing away. And then all of a sudden, maybe you'll hear something or you'll read something and you'll think, oh, that's what will help them. Let me let me get to work on this because I can right. fix it. And we flip so easily, right. You know, and that hope lures us in. And then, so we cycle, we go in and out of it. And it's, so when you find yourself doing that, know that it's normal and course correct and say, okay, well, I just went down the rabbit hole on this. And do I want to? And how am I behaving? Oh, I look at my bids for familiarity. I'm trying to engage them so that I can give them this nugget they need to get fixed, but yes, can't.
Yes.
It's
yes.
right.
And it's very much like you said earlier of the prolonged grief stage of there are people in marriages and child relationships, child parent, child relationships that have been doing this dance for so long that has become their identity. There is opportunity to change that, but it starts with you and not them.
It sure does. You said that so beautifully. And something that might also help support that, that action is to understand, you know, it's understandable why people are doing this, why a mother and father aren't, you know, why they are still practicing external hope for their child, whether the child is 16 and, you know, has run away from home, or the child is 20 and estranged, or the child is 40 and has a substance abuse disorder. Whatever the case is, love is a powerful force. And people behave this way in large part because the love is there, right? And grief is proportionate to love. When our barista, you know, quits, or our mail carrier gets assigned to a new route, you're probably not crying about it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because you don't love them. You might appreciate them and value them and even enjoy, you know, wave when you see them, but that's not love. Love is a mighty force. And so grief is proportionate to the love we have for somebody. So grief isn't something that you're gonna move through right away. Just like love was built over time with a spouse, you know, or a best friend, and you know, that instant incredible bond of a parent's love, you know, that doesn't just shut off, and nor should it, right? We can keep love there while we also work to love ourselves, right? And by acknowledging our powerlessness to change anyone else, we can turn the spotlight on ourselves and do the work, the hard, yes. uncomfortable, painful work.
Yes.
That's
and
being
be very
to
powerful
us.
In that space. We're it's extremely empowering. Powerful in our own space. And when we change ourselves, the external has to change. They may not change the way we want, but they have to change in response to us. And we're walking into the boundaries territory right there. But there's one thing that you said in the book. You said great loss means that you have experienced great love. I'm sure I don't have it exactly right, but that's the amazing gratitude piece in there, which you talk about as well. And then you walk into meaning and forgiveness. Share a little bit more about this stage that has been added to the 7 stages of grieving. Now we've got an 8, I'm right, number wise. And now we've got an 8th stage that's meaning, and then forgiveness.
So
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, meaning was added recently to indicate that while we're grieving the loss of a loved one, looking for and finding meaning can be a salve, right? And help us in our healing. Now, that doesn't always work. For ambiguous grievers, that doesn't always work, right? Again, because if you've had a physical death that you're grieving, you're not hoping to see them again. Not really, mm-hmm. anyway. You can hope to see them in another life. You can hope to see them in your dreams, but you don't hope they're going to ring your doorbell or send a text or give you a call, right? But with ambiguous grievers, we do. And mm-hmm. depending on what the activating event is that has caused this relationship to change so drastically, if not end altogether, whether we understand why or not, mm-hmm. meaning might be something that helps. to say, okay, well, you know, I've practiced all this internal hope, and this must, you know, I see that this must, this has meaning. This loss I've had has meaning because now I can help others who are, for example, going through, you know, the 12-step program, others who are, you know, we can find a way to help others. And that's true. If you can find meaning in your loss, and if it's helpful to you, great. I kind of put an asterisk here and say, meaning might not be for everybody. There are some losses that are just beyond searching for meaning, beyond assigning meaning. There are some losses that will never feel better because there's been some good that's come of it, right? Or some meaning that's come of it. So I say this about forgiveness too. If you find meaning soothing and helpful in your healing, great. But don't go looking for it. Don't try to assign and attach. Oh, this must be why. This must be it. Just let that go if you can. And if there's a meaning with your grief, you'll find it along the way. Stay open to looking for it. Because it's not always there.
You peg forgiveness in the same way of, if you had a lot of people saying, you need to just forgive, you need to just forgive. And you're like, wait a minute. I'm not there.
Yeah. Forgiveness became.
Whew,
yeah. Gosh, I can feel my body just reacting now because it's been such, it's been such an evolution for me, you know, personally, and, you know, really, understanding it. Yeah. To your point, I had people in my life who I love and respected say, well, okay, here's what you have to do. You've got to forgive and move on, forgive and forget, forgive. And, you know, and I would hear people share, good people, good, kind hearted people share with me. And then in one case, I had an insistent person basically proclaiming, it was a requirement. You have got to forgive right now or you will never heal. And everything in my body rejected that.
Mm-hmm.
And I later came to understand it in this way, that saying we forgive somebody when we don't really feel that can cause problems. And healing doesn't start when forgiveness is given or is felt. I really believe that that's where it ends, right? Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is kind of the end cap here. Mm-hmm. You don't find it in the beginning. You grow into it throughout the process. And this is my own personal experience, and I've seen it in countless others. And when people, you know, we have such a, again, like hope, forgiveness is good. Forgiveness is a good thing. It's poison to keep it. Every, you know, major faith, spiritual teachers will tell you it's no good. You don't want to keep hate and anger. You want to forgive. Right. You want to release it. You want to let it go. It only hurts you. It only hurts you. We understand this. And then, you know, in the 17th century or 18th century, we heard, you know, this poem, where in it says that, you know, to forgive is divine, and etiquette books started, you know, coming out telling us that, you know, we accept an apology, because that's, especially that's what women do. We need to accept the apology, and then we offer forgiveness. And so when you take, you know, etiquette and faith and you blend it, I believe it's left us with a misinterpretation of what forgiveness is and how to find it. And in fact, I say, don't find it. Don't, if you're somebody who is just so, you know, you want to forgive. And so you say, yes, I forgive you. But then you feel awful about it later, or you feel like, I don't really forgive them. I just had to say it because it's the right thing to do. And I'm a good person, or it's part of my faith and I need to say it. Well, you're not tricking anybody. Right. And what it does, when you say you forgive somebody and you don't, then what you've done is you've gone out of your own integrity, and your body knows that. Your central nervous system knows this, that you're out of alignment. And as a result when we're out of our own integrity, you know, because we've lied about something, anything, it can raise our blood pressure. We can have, you know, anxiety, stress. There's a whole host of things that can happen that aren't good for our bodies and our bodies and our minds. It's a body, mind, spirit connection. And the if we can stay in our integrity and tell the truth, we're in a better place. And if the truth is, you know, I'm thank you for your care. That's what I learned to say to people. Thank you for your care. And then be open to letting forgiveness find you. Because if you're saying it and you don't mean it, I call that faux-giveness. It's fake. Mm-hmm. And it's not helping anybody. But if you can, you know, when you say, you know what, I'm open. I don't feel it. I'm open to it coming to me, to finding it, to learning about it. I believe we create space to work with the divine. I believe we create space to experience authentic forgiveness. And what we find in authentic forgiveness, no surprise, is love.
Absolutely.
It all comes back to love.
And with the biblical context, I mean, we're instructed to do that. God doesn't give us all this clear timing as far as that's concerned. And what I like about that, those chapters in the book, is this is a process and it may take a little while. And my own personal experience with it, especially with a best friendship loss, was it took some time. And as I began to unravel it and unroll it, I saw the gifts that were in there and that I needed to look at. And I still wasn't quite there with forgiveness. I mean, it took about 2 years, but then as I processed it and worked with it more and more, I went, if I had forgiven right away, I wouldn't even been forgiving the right thing. I wouldn't even have been forgiving the right act. I had to process through this to be able to look at, oh, that's really the piece that needs to be forgiven. And I had to start with some self-forgiveness, which if you go through Soul Broken, you're going to see that all the way through. I had to start with some self-forgiveness around what I was judging. Let's put it this way. What I was judging to be right versus when I was able to step back after 2 years, look at it more globally, go, oh, that really it was important for them to act that way. It was important for me to act the way that I did. And we had to work through some of those processes. Now that friendship has not been restored. It didn't just magically restore when I was ready to give forgiveness. And that's a piece that I think when you talk about it in the book, as you talk about the internal hope, when you're standing in your own integrity and own authenticity, this is what I think God talks about biblically. When we're standing in our own integrity, own authenticity, and we are ready to give forgiveness, it doesn't matter if the other person accepts it or not. We have done what's important for us. We have, for me, created our up and down alignment. And then I'm trying to create this kind of alignment, but that person may never accept it. And that's okay, because I've done what I needed to do. So there isn't this, I'm giving you a gift, you need to give me something back. Then that's what I got out of your processing of forgiveness, was it wasn't like, oh, I've got to do this because I need to be part of this church, or I need to do this for my kids, or I need to do that. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't respect people as human beings and be civil. I'm just saying that,
right.
Yeah, you know, the forgiveness might not be there yet. It may take some processing. There is one thing that I want to tackle. So I say this all the time, and I liked your take on it. I say, this is happening for me, not to me. Now, you have a very different take on that, because I see this as, I'm able to calculate this is happening for me. So I look through and I go, what's the lesson here for me? What's important for me to look at? Where do I need to manage my emotions and not dysregulate? Now, I may still dysregulate, but you have another take on it. Can you share that with us?
I'm curious give me a hint, because I have a couple different ways I travel on that. What are you thinking?
You don't just accept it at face value. You have some other things that you say about it in the book, and you're like, maybe this is not okay just to look at this like this.
Right.
Is that enough of a hint?
And yeah, I think so. I mean, steer me back if I go down the wrong rabbit hole here, but yeah, because it's grief is highly individualized, just like love. And so I'm not, you know, I'm not superior. I don't know the way. I am offering what I've learned by the grace of others who have shared their stories with me and by my own calling to share my story. And that doesn't mean that's how somebody else has to do it. And the offerings I suggest in the book may not be, you know, helpful to you. But because of all of that, you know, somebody who's in the mud, if you are just feeling just that heavy loss of a friend or a spouse, whomever you're grieving. And if your grief isn't ambiguous, if there is a physical death affiliated with it, platitudes don't help, right? And I'm not, you know, so I often say, I'm not going to pick up my pom-poms and tell you that this is good and this is happening for you and you're going to be better on the other side. Because I don't know if that's true. What I do know, what I personally believe, what has been my experience, and I see it as the experience of others, is that grief, as awful as it is also a portal. It is a portal to our greatest and highest nature if we let it. But the only way we can do that is by going through the mud. Is feeling our feelings, is accepting our powerlessness to fix somebody else, to change somebody else. I mean, even that language is wrong. We can't fix anybody. Nobody, they're not broken, right? They're having an experience that is only, you're only invited to a part of that experience, right? But the real deep healing work is not your job. And you're just not powerful enough to make it your job. You have to turn that over.
Not only are they not broken, but you're not broken either because you can't fix them. So you're not broken either because you didn't save your child. You didn't play savior for your spouse. You didn't fix the situation over here. You are not broken either. You are, every one of us is creative, resourceful, and whole from the beginning. And sorry, I love when you say that, is that this is a portal. I think that's where most of us get locked up and we don't have a whole lot of ritual around that, is instead of this being a portal and we walk through it, we wall up around it, panic, do anxiety, say, I can't do that. Whereas if we just, you know, my body goes ugh sometimes when I have to do this. Whereas if we just take the first step in, feel the pain, feel the grief, feel the anger, feel the frustration, feel all those feelings that go with it, it will pass through us and we won't stay stuck, which I think Soul Broken is such a magnificent piece of work. And you did a heck of a audience. You're going to have to read her story because she did a heck of a lot of work to get where she is. And you're getting the fruit of all of this labor and can sit back and not be in the jungle. I'll leave that just as a teaser, not be in the jungle. Right. Doing all the things she did to do this, the physical jungle. So Stephanie, I really just want to thank you for your amazing journey, that this is just a wonderful piece that you have put together for us. I am glad that it's coming to the surface because I didn't even know the term, and it has helped me so much think about my life. And then we haven't even really touched on the whole ritual piece, the, you know, you have a quote in there, pain from soul brokenness does not go away, it assimilates. We haven't even really talked about that. So there's so much more that Sober on Purpose friends, you can get from this book. So I really am excited for you to pick it up. You can pick it up on audio, Kindle, anything like that. You will have highlights all over it. And Stephanie, I really look forward to talking with you again when we can get into some more things. Are there kind of tie-ups you want to share with the Sober on Purpose audience?
Just really thank you. You know, I'm for anybody listening who can relate to this, or who maybe a light has kind of turned on inside of you because it's familiar to you. I just want to honor that your or your loss is real and your pain is valid, and that there is a way forward, a way to reimagine your life and be happy, actually come to a place of peace and happiness while still loving the person you're grieving from afar. And so I just deep bow to anybody who embarks on this work and, you know, creates the rituals, finds a community who, you know, supports, really understands that it's a process. You know, it is, to your point, it's hard work. You feel, ugh, when you realize you have more work to do. But again, boy, it's, you come out of it more than recovered, you come out of it regenerated. And it's a gift if we allow it. So thank you for having me. And my thoughts are with your listeners and anyone embarking on this brave hike of a life. You can do it. And I'm rooting for you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tanya.
You, beloved listener, are creative, resourceful, and whole. Do you want to add more purpose to your sober journey? Do you want to make room for the new and make your dreams a reality? Apply today for a dream session. Go to tanyajoya.com. That's TanyaGioia.com and apply today. Let's get you dreaming about your new purpose.